morning, Your Honor. Just the court. My name is Quinn Dender, federal defender from Sacramento, and I represent Mr. Hightower. Mr. Hightower was charged with leaving the city of Sacramento minor, and it was alleged that he, and then knowing he carried a sentence of 3, 6, or 8 years under California law. However, it was alleged that he had suffered two prior convictions of the same sort, one in 1978 and one in 1982. As a result of that, his sentence for being convicted of the prior or the present offense and the prior was found to be true was 15 years of life. And because the 1982 offense was a serious felony under California law, it was doubled to 30 years of life. If he'd gone to trial, most that he would have faced would have been 31 years of life. He would have gotten an additional year because he had served a prior prison term. Instead, he pled guilty and got 30 years of life. We have basically three challenges that I'd like to talk about to the sentence. One is the question of his competency to even enter a plea at the time. The second is the advice of Boykin tolerates about the priors in this proceeding before he admitted these priors that occurred in this proceeding. Was he adequately advised that he actually waived his rights? And the third question goes to whether his attorney in the state court proceeding here in 1994-1995 was ineffective in failing to mount a challenge to the 1978 conviction. If he had mounted that, we believe he would have shown that it could not have been used to enhance the sentence. Mr. Hightower would be looking at a maximum of 16 years, of which he would be able to get parole at 50% rather than
I don't want to take you out of your order, but your third issue, isn't that foreclosed by Lackawanna?
Your Honor, I don't believe it is. And Lackawanna says that we cannot, as we did in one of our claims, ask on habeas to have a prior conviction declared invalid. But it does not foreclose, I believe, our raising a Strickland claim about how this was handled. There's a procedure in California where you are charged with a prior conviction, no matter how old that conviction is, whether you're in custody on it or not.
Yeah, but how do you show prejudice?
Excuse me?
How do you show prejudice?
As to that necessary point. The prejudice would be that they can't use that against him if it was found to be invalid. There's a motion to strike priors.
But you can't under costs.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's correct. What I think the difference is that we're not asking the court to find this court to make a determination of the whether that is a proper prior. In other words, we're not bringing up a Boykin Tall challenge to that. What we're asking you to do is look at state counsel's performance in 1940, 1994, 1995 in failing to use an existing state remedy to strike that prior. And California law was and still is, no matter when, even if you cannot challenge that prior in a habeas corpus in its own right, if the state uses it to enhance your sentence, you can't.
But in order to do that, you have to be able to show that there was something wrong with that decision that he should have. That he should have challenged, which is the prejudice, as I understand it.
I think I know what
And I don't know how do you do that.
Well, I think I did it by giving you the
But so we're just around. We're the same place that we were before. Isn't that an end run around Lackawanna?
Oh, I don't understand the run. It may be that you're going to resolve that question, but Lackawanna really is a very specific matter. I mean, Lackawanna said that if you've exhausted your state remedy or failed to use it, then you can't come into federal court, right, and ask the federal court to strike. This gentleman never had an opportunity to use that state remedy that was available to him. He had a remedy in state court. So he didn't have a remedy to file a habeas corpus challenging his 1978. But he did have, as soon as the state said, we want to use the 78 to enhance your sentence, then under a case called People versus Sunstein, he had a right to move to strike the prior. So it can say you can't. Forget about its validity. It cannot be used to enhance a sentence. And that's what counsel didn't do. Counsel didn't do what any counsel would do, which is say, if they're going to enhance the sentenced to this great degree. And what I need to do is I need to get the records.
Well, suppose there was no reason to do it. Are you asking for a for some kind of rule that if the prior conviction wasn't challenged, that therefore it can never be used? That's a very odd rule.
I have a client who's charged with living serious now.
Yeah.
There are two prior convictions that they have alleged against him. They don't have to allege them, but they decided to allege in order to trigger this 15 to life.
Right.
Then don't I have a duty, and I have a right under state law to move to strike those priors on Roykenthal grounds. In this proceeding, not file a separate habeas, which I can't do because I'm no longer in custody on this. But if they want to use it under state law, then I can file it. I think it's my duty and privilege to get the records on those to see if they can be challenged under Roykenthal. Because if they can be challenged, then my trial court will strike them and say, well, that can't be used in this case.
Okay.
And I'll give you the case. People versus Sunstein, which is 32nd Cal 3rd 909. And then that's been reaffirmed in People versus Allen, which is 21 Cal 4th 424. Motion to strike priors can be brought, even though you could not bring a separate habeas to challenge the priors at the same time.
Did you submit those cases to the court?
I don't think they have a question, Your Honor. No, there isn't a question on this.
They're not in the briefs. Have you submitted them opposing counsel? I mean, the two California cases you just cited there was.
No, I haven't.
You should and would you get?
Yeah.
But this goes to the California procedures.
Yeah. So this is the answer to the question. Do you want to know if there's a California procedure? Right. I realize we haven't filled that gap. So our point is, If counsel had done this job, he would have gone over and got these records from Blaine County. He would have seen that the records I presented you by motion of judicial notice. He would have said, I'm going to move to strike this prior because it doesn't meet Roykenthal grounds. The judge would have said, correct. And then the most they would have had is one prior conviction against Mr. Hightower, which would have meant that he would have a 16-year sentence maximum instead of 30 to life.
Let me ask you a slightly different question. Did you actually raise that issue in your opening brief?
Yes, failure.
Ineffective assistance counsel?
Absolutely.
Where?
Absolutely.
Maybe you could let me know where it is. Not, you don't have to act on rebuttal. Don't waste your time now. Okay. Yeah, okay. But just...
It's raised...
It isn't real easy because I didn't see it. But that means I could have missed it. But anyway... Okay. Okay.
And he's raised all along to the ineffective assistance and challenge of the prior. So that's, and our another point on the underlying Roykenthal is, and we actually take judicial notice of those records. Now, those records were not before the district court. I'll concede that. They did not rule on that. The reason was Mr. Hightower did not have counsel. He wrote several times to get the records. He was told they weren't available. I was able to send a paralegal up to Glenn County who found them down in the basement of the courthouse and they copies of them served by the comes to you. But I think if you look at the records, it's pretty clear that he was not given that there was a Roykenthal error and counsel brought that to the state court's attention. They were struck that he would not be facing the sentence he's facing now. The other two issues are somewhat related. One is the question of the competency of the second trial, or at least the whole evidentiary hearing in federal court on that.
Did you request an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, he did.
That shows in the record.
Yeah, even though he's not represented by counsel, if he had gotten an evidentiary hearing, he would have had counsel. But he only had counsel appointed by this court later on. I think the key thing about this may be the fact that he was taking Thorazine, because I think Thorazine... I'm looking into it, Thorazine. It's quite an amazing drug. It's a psychotropic mind-altering drug. And one of the key things, and he was taking a substantial amount. He was taking 50 milligrams in the morning, 100 milligrams at night at the time of his plea. That was later decreased to 300 milligrams at the time of his right after his plea. But the important thing about this drug is that it has the unusual property of inducing a state of relevant relative indifference to stressful situations.
Well, you know, he may have been on a bazillion drugs and apparently was, but that doesn't necessarily indicate that he was unable to appreciate what was going on. He represented himself for a time. He asked questions of the court when he didn't get what was being asked of him, and he manifested had no manifestations of confusion or mental instability or whatever that would have clued the trial judge at the time to pursue a hearing.
Well, we take one by one. He represented himself for approximately a month, through which he did nothing.
Well, I know, but the point is that he didn't manifest anything that would have given anybody a clue, including his lawyer, including the judge, that he couldn't assist in his defense.
His lawyer had been told by his wife about her concerns and did nothing about it. If he'd gotten these records, he would have seen the Thorazine. And there is something. At one point, he admitted something. They asked him, do you understand that this comes from under section so-and-so? And he said, yes. And then the judge happened to ask, do you know what that means? And he said, no. He also admitted two priors. He admitted that these were forcible oral copulations. They weren't. They weren't charged that way. He admitted prior crimes.
Well, it doesn't mean they weren't. It just means they weren't charged that way.
No, but I think they were both. But it was a conviction, of course, of oral copulation. It was not. It was an oral copulation of different men. That's a big thing. When you admit crimes, you can admit. And the other thing, what I'm trying to say about the Thorazine, it has an unusual side. What it does is it reduces a state of relative indifference to stressful situations. In other words, you don't care. The reason it was developed was for surgical patients, because if you gave them this, they became kind of indifferent to the surgery. And Justice Kennedy's talked about it in a concurring opinion, and has talked about it, what it can do. And it said that it basically leads to the defendant's loss of self-determination, undermining his desire for self-preservation, which is necessary to engage the defendant in his own defense. And that makes a lot of sense here when you have somebody who's pleading guilty for 30 years to life, when the most that could happen in the trial would be 31 years to life. It's just a pretty illusory bargain. And so I think that authority, I agree, you can take some medication, but this happens to be a very unusual medication, because it almost disables you from defending yourself. That's the nature of it. That's the purpose of it. He was taking a lot of it. He entered into an illusory plea bargain at a time when he admitted crimes he had, prior convictions he didn't have. He said he understood things he didn't understand. I think it's certainly enough to get a hearing. That's the competency question. Now, the separate question of Boykin-Tall as to the priors, this was a situation where the court did a perfectly proper job of advising as to those rights when it came to priors and express waivers.
What exactly do you contend that court ought to have asked with respect to the priors? I'm not clear on what you wanted to
ask. Oh, I think that what it should have asked is what you probably find in almost every other one, which would have said, now we're going to go to the prior convictions. Do you understand you have the right to a jury trial on those? Do you want to give up that right? Do you have a right to defend the witnesses? Do you want to give up that right? Do you have a right to sleep? Same thing.
And your quarrel is that he did that by shorthand by saying, you know, everything I just asked you applies to the priors, too. I mean, is that the real what this comes down to, or is there something different?
The real was a dual problem. One is that he took the admission of the priors without saying anything at all, took the plea and then said, not even the priors. Then counsel said, well, what about the constitutional rights? The judge seemed surprised. What constitutional rights? And then they did this kind of bumbling thing where they said, do you give up whatever rights you have?
Yeah, so it's constitutional error not to have done, to flip the order? And what's the constitutional error? That's what I'm trying to get.
Well, under Castellon, you're supposed to be advised of and aware of your rights prior to the plea, not afterwards. This court said you can't take a plea and then afterwards advise the person of the rights and say, well, that's sufficient now that they say they have the rights and they understand them.
Look, he
at least give them the opportunity to withdraw that, the plea remission,
okay,
before you do. So that's the problem with that.
Are you suggesting that with respect to each prior, it has to be done separately, or that it can be done with respect to all the priors.
I think you could have done both priors. You could merely say that each of these priors you get these rights. And that's what's generally done. That is not a foreign procedure in California. That is normally done because the law is very clear from this court and the California Supreme Court that you have those avoidance law rights along those lines.
Is there any case that says that has to be done?
In what sense?
As to priors.
Yes, there is. We cited in there, there's one of your cases in In Re Yurko, the California case, and there's one of your cases which is cited here, Craven versus someone that I recall, that says that just as you do for a plea, an admission of prior, you have exactly the same appointment followed. And I would like to reserve some time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you mind commenting on his last remark about Wright versus Craven, that a separate and full recitation of constitutional rights is required with respect to the priors?
I do believe that you have to have the constitutional rights. However, there is no formulaic separate that you have to do it in terms of they have to be knowing involved.
But isn't he claiming that the one exception in Lackawanna was where there's a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, that basically he didn't have counsel. He had counsel, but he had ineffective counsel.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but the fact is that there is it's still a bootstrapping of the whole lack of an IAC claim to bring in to attack prior conviction. It's just existing. It eviscerates lack of honor, first of all, lack of honor to prevent the defense from doing that. And I understand the fact that it's better saying that it's not counsel, but he was represented by counsel in that 1978 proceeding. The jury has been represented by counsel all along. That, you know, the counsel at the prior proceeding in 1978, he was there all that time, he was off sentence, and he was never a claim that he was not a prosecutor. So, right, that he did not understand what was happening in any of those proceedings. It just seems
Are there any further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Denver?
Well, I guess unless the court has any other questions, I just wanted to go back to the last one of those cases, because I think that it's a strong case. But it doesn't deal with the situation we have here. In Lackawanna, the defendant was unable to send habeas corpus because he was no longer in custody under that particular sentence that was being used to enhance it. California happens to have a procedure that says, you know, you may not be able to bring it to habeas corpus just to set that aside in general, but you are allowed, when the state wants to use it against you, to challenge it. This motion to strike the prior. And I don't think Lackawanna just doesn't deal with that. I mean, it's a California procedure. California practitioners are supposed to be aware of it. California practitioners look to priors all the time to see if they're valid or not, if it's going to have a huge effect. I think this is the question of Lackawanna. And as far as the other questions.
Thank you very much. The case just argued is submitted for decision. All right. We'll hear the next case on the calendar, United States versus McCoy and Davis.